Welcome to 24 Hours Don't Make an Ideology, the resurrected show about the 69th TV show, the best of the 21st century. I am your host, this time actually recording live, hopefully, Ryan Swen, along with
Ian.
And thank you very much for, if you did actually listen to our Frankenstein episode, the Deep State's attempts to silence us, I hope that it wasn't too painful of a listen, and it actually ended up being kind of fun just going through it, but it was something that had to be done, basically.
Ryan's being incredibly modest. He saved the day with his technical wizardry.
Well, I tarnished the day then saved it, so.
Well, it's not really your fault, you know. Technology is actually filled with ghosts. So the ghosts did it, and yes. And you worked to subvert their mischief, and yeah. It worked out, honestly.
I'm thinking, like, maybe it was a tweet or something like that where someone said like everyone is just like the tiny little creatures inside my laptop screen or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, basically like that.
That's very much how I feel about almost all technology.
Yeah.
Like anything with like too many circuit boards. Mm-hmm. Like I have a rudimentary understanding of like how, you know, a guitar amplifier works, right? That's I think like a very different level of technology where it's like, okay, like I could take this thing apart and learn about it and like do things to it, and I just don't feel that way at all about any of the technology I use like habitually to do like bullshit online.
Right. I mean, it's basically, you know, the black hat, just these sort of waves of currents going around inside your computer. That's basically as good a representation as I can think of. And it's just, the black hat hackers in my computer are trying to stop this. But we're back, and hopefully this will record. And we're here to talk about the hours from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. on day one of 24 as we approach the end, but it doesn't really feel like we're approaching the end. Like, it's sort of like, it doesn't feel like there's only two episodes left to me for some strange reason. Maybe it's just because we've been just going through these. And so it's just been, you know, just been sort of weird to, for me personally, to watch like serialized, like a longer season TV and remember that, like that it just like stops at a certain point.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I feel like I'm kind of beating a dead horse by bringing this up again, but I really do think the show, this season of the show is probably going to end up being an outlier as far as the pacing goes a little bit because of the like conditions of its production. Although I'm interested to see how the season during the writer's strike handles that. But yeah, I mean, it does feel like the second half of the season has just kept restarting and restarting and restarting. And then by the time Kim gets kidnapped in one of these episodes for like what feels like the fifth time in the season, I just like laughed. Because they just like keep going back to that well, you know?
Yeah, and like the only difference is basically like Kim is struggling a little bit more. It's just like like you can almost see like the expression on Elijah Cuthbert's face, like this is happening again.
Oh, why is this happening again?
It's just like insane why they would think to do that again. Like it sort of gets an interesting sort of like flip of like Terry and Kim being captured together. I guess they're not really in the same truck at that point, right? Or is Kim just like knocked out in the truck at the end? I think they're probably in different cars.
So
it's just like,
yeah, because then they bring her in later when Jack is in that like weird basement lair,
right? Yeah. that's actually a really good moment, I think, like when like Victor Drazen is being Victor Drazen. And we'll definitely get a lot of good Victor Drazen, but like it's just like a shot of him, and then the door opens and Kim is just brought in. There's, you don't hear anything happening before that. So it's like a nice sort of, like, you know, she's being captured by the Drazens because there's literally no one else who could do that. But it's just like this very like fluid transition to like another revelation for Jack. I feel like these episodes are like paced really weirdly, or like just like the imbalance is coming back again, like of importance of storylines. The Palmer stuff has gone back to not working for me again.
Oh my gosh. I sort of, as we were going through this season, you know, because I've talked about this before, I barely remember anything that's happened in this show aside from the broadest strokes. But I did sort of feel like, wait, isn't there like a thing between Palmer and his like speechwriter? And then that kept not happening, and I was like, I don't know, maybe that's a later season, maybe I just don't know what I'm talking about. And then it's like, they just flipped a switch. I mean, and we sort of get like, you do kind of get this sort of like over-the-top reveal of like, you know, Penny Johnson Gerald just being, you know, like evil, you know, sort of machinations.
Stealing a maraschino cherry.
Yeah, yeah. But at the same time, it's like, there's absolutely no, there doesn't seem to be any real sort of like motivation for Patty to be in on this or to be doing any of this or like anything that, like, it's just such a strange, and it really does, particularly for episode 21, it really does feel like the writers just like hit the panic button on the Palmer story. And we're just like, okay, he's going to start flirting with this woman and having an affair in the last four episodes.
Yeah, it's just like the thing where like, and they even, I was wondering if they would even bring Palmer back and like for Jack stuff, and they do. So like, why did they feel the compulsive need to bring this completely random sort of affair, and like, because she is in some of the other episodes, but like she's never really felt like she's apparently his campaign manager to a speech writer, but it doesn't really feel like there's a she never really felt anything close to central.
I mean, so, she's like a tertiary character in the tertiary storyline of the show. And like, I don't think the performance is bad or anything. I don't even think it's necessarily like a bad character. It just feels so odd. Like, and I think there's a certain restlessness that the show can't handle when other storylines outside of Jack's are kind of like I felt like the Palmer stuff was at a perfect spot where there was enough still unresolved to like open up in a following season. But at the same time, it felt like a natural stopping place for that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess the writers were just like, well, be that as it may, we still have 4 hours we have to fill, and like, we still have to have these people in it. But yeah, I mean, you know, like, I would have just watched Mike vibe out at the celebration party for a while. Like, I just think they're trying so hard at this point.
Yeah.
That being said, though, you know, Penny Johnson Gerald once again demonstrates that she really does understand what makes this show work, and just like plays it up like crazy.
Yeah. And it's like the sort of politicking of it. Like it's like, it does, like how she says like there, it's like it's just begun or something like that with what he has to do to like win election.
Yeah.
So yeah, like it's sort of like in those moments that like it does feel like it has an understanding. And yes, I do. It was sort of like, because you first see in the sort of when Palmer is giving his like sort of victory speech to his workers, and it like it's a good fun speech. And you just like, you first see like, you know, from behind, you see like what you can clearly tell is like Mike's sort of balding head like sort of sway up and down, and then when Palmer says like for everyone that like he orders everyone to have a good time, he just like leans back and he has this just beautiful smile on his face, and it's just this such a wonderful shot after he's been the real politic guy for the past day.
It's really great. Again, like, but they just can't like take the W. They have to keep pouring it on.
Yeah, and like they didn't, and the thing is like they didn't really set up Palmer to be like anything like that you would never even consider him having an affair, I feel like. Well, or like, you know, like there was sort of like at the opening in the premiere, like there was sort of that possibility, but like since then it seems like it's never felt like that.
I almost feel like it would have been more effective just to have the reveal that he had an ongoing affair.
Yeah, I agree.
Because it's only been a day. Like, it's been an insane day. There would be no chance for them to meet. And then all of a sudden to have this moment where it's like, that to me would be, on the one hand, like, all right, maybe sort of cheap to drum up drama, but I think it would have been, like, effective in an interesting way to be like, oh, you think you know this person, you know, this kind of white knight type of guy, but it turns out that, like, he's overcompensating because he's doing this, you know? Whereas here it feels like, okay, you know, he's found out over the course of this day that his marriage is like a sham at this point, and it's just like all of this real politic. You know, I mean, I think this is where the show suffers a little bit from the time constraints, because in the normal course of a season where this took place over like weeks or months, like a sudden kind of like plot line developing like this would feel less less forced. But because it's like, okay, you literally found out like 6 hours ago about all this stuff. Like, I don't think he's going to be jumping into some kind of like tenuous like affair, you know?
Yeah, and the fact that it just comes in so suddenly, like once like they're alone like in the room together, you immediately know, oh, this is what the show's gonna try to do. And it's just this inexplicable thing, like you get, you know, you get the sense that they're trying to make you think that it's that it's creeping up simply because they don't have him like actually asking her, are you flirting with me, until the end of until basically 10 p.m.
but
you can tell immediately from the first first moment that it just doesn't feel, and that, like, you know, he asked her to go up to his room and just like all this sort of things where it would absolutely not make sense for him to do that.
So they're definitely fumbling the ball there, but I also want to say that I really do think that Leslie Hope had the worst job on television for 1 year. And I feel so bad for knowing how this all ends. I mean, she must have been so pissed when she read that last script. And at the same time, elated. Like, on the one hand, you know, you think, okay, I'm going to be in this show. Like, we got another season order. This feels pretty good. I've got a job, whatever. And, you know, maybe you think, all right, well, you know, the character development this season for my character is not the best. But, like, you know, it takes time on television or whatever. And then it's like,
hey. I'm the main character's wife.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I have a good position here.
And it's like, no, you were actually a sacrificial lamb the whole time. And also, for the last 6 hours, we're just going to make you kind of wander around mentally and be the most annoying person in any scene that you're in.
Now I'm thinking about it, like, really in relation to Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Like, what was the point where people started to feel, like, was it Max von Sydow, where, like, he was only in it for one season and he got out?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm thinking, like, somewhere in that range where it's just, like, it's becoming clear that the show's not going to quite do as well. Like, it's not going to quite serve your character as well as you might think it would.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's just, it's so awful. This. But we also, it's so awful, and yet we get a beautiful Mason scene out of it.
We do. I will say, like, man, Xander Berkeley is bringing it in these episodes. These are probably not the two best episodes of the show to watch after being away for a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, I think this is the worst Hopkins episode.
Yeah.
And we get a Paul Shapiro episode, which I don't think we've had one from him so far. But man, Xander Berkeley is just, he's killing it.
Yeah.
Just like the way he deals with all of this is so, so calloused. And like, but really brings like a lightness to the scenes in a way. Like, he just plays a jackass so phenomenally well. It's just beautiful. Every scene he's in is just fantastic.
Yeah. I guess, like, what Nina says about him is probably true, that he's, like, a, like, very political, very, like, ambitious, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it's sort of, like, you tend to really forget about it in the moment just because he's so there.
Yeah, yeah.
He just has such a great way of just, like, dealing with Terry and, like, calming her, like, legitimately calming her, and then calling his assistant to just keep her out of his face.
I get the sense, and I mean, this comes entirely from the performance, because the writers don't care, but I get that sense from the performance that he's the kind of guy who is really ambitious, but just does not have the kind of niceties and kind of like cynical charisma to like get where he wants to be. And I think that's what makes the performance so interesting, because it's kind of a guy who knows that he's a little bit stuck. He's a little bit resentful of that. But because of that, like, yeah, he's just like, he's able to play it in this great way where, again, I'm dreaming of a show where we get, you know, Jack Bauer, George Mason, like buddy cops, which would be like a perfect dynamic, which is like one guy who's just totally like tunnel vision driven and not ambitious seemingly. And then another guy, but has all of the ability. Right. And then you have George Mason, who is incredibly ambitious, but like lacks the a couple of the necessary qualities to really make it all the way.
Right.
You know, I
really liked him unholstering his pistol and going, hold it right there. like he's like in a he's in a like a in the Wild West.
Clearly like he, the first time from he's his, done like, that.
Shoulder holster. But
like it's been a while since he's done that. I'm surprised he didn't forget to bring his gun with him, you know. Yeah, Mason really, because once again, like CTU is where the show goes to die. But as long as George Mason is there, it'll at least be somewhat worth it.
Yeah, I need you to resolve this for me.
Okay.
Do the writers know yet that they're actually going to make Nina the mole?
Okay, I was going to ask you this question too, because as our listeners will remember, I've been thinking for a few episodes now that maybe they had that in the back of their minds or were starting to lay that groundwork. But then I watched these two episodes, and I still think they have no idea how they're going to close this baby out. They have 2 hours left, and I do not, there is no, like, maybe the one thing here, which is not made much of and which, like, we don't know enough about to really say anything, is the Kim kidnapping, right? Which is, like, there are only a couple of people who know that Kim is coming with this cop to CTU. Mm-hmm. It's basically, like, I mean, I think George Mason knows, Nina knows, and Tony knows, and Terry, of course.
Yeah.
So that this gets intercepted is like perhaps the first sort of real clue of like there's still someone else. But you could just as easily write that out as like Drazen's got people.
Yeah. Like it seems
it
like,
would be
you know,
super
they're leaving. Yeah. They're leaving the police station. You know, there's plenty of they're driving in like an alley or something like that.
Yeah.
It's a very good spot for an ambush.
Yes. Yeah.
So, he probably has people connected with the police, so he probably knows that someone named Kim Bauer is being transported to CTU. So, like, it's not really a extremely difficult thing to make. And they haven't mentioned the possibility of there being a second mole in like 10 episodes.
It's been ages, yeah.
Yeah, so it's yeah, and I think that when they brought up when Nina was like looking, like tracking, and like you know looking at the map of the underground prison,
yeah.
Like, I was thinking, oh, will this be the time where something goes wrong? Or like, but it's just, like, completely external stuff.
Yes, yeah.
And so it's just, like, and basically just Nina otherwise is just doing the same how's Jack doing thing. And then to compound that, we have Terry doing the how's Jack, how's Kim doing thing to her.
Yeah.
So it's just, like, this continuing chain of wasted time, basically.
Yeah, there were a couple moments, like the ones you mentioned, where I thought, okay, now they're going to do some kind of knowing, sinister hold, right? Like, we're going to get a moment where, at the time, you may not make much of it, but in retrospect, you'll be like, ah. But yeah, no, we get none of that. and honestly, having watched the whole season of this show, almost, I really think that they're just spinning their wheels trying to figure out how to get out of this. I really do think like what a third of the dialogue in these episodes is either like Terry or Nina being like, what's going on with Jack? How is Jack? And like talking about the things that we as like that they don't know that we as the viewer are seeing with Jack, but like they don't have anything to say about them. It's just like, okay, here's a scene. You're gonna ask how Jack is. You're gonna reassure her, like the end. And that's the whole scene. And then we cut to the commercial, and it's it's brutal.
It's very brutal. I mean, like in terms of spinning wheels, I especially like the second scene in episode 21 where we get about 2 minutes of Kim in the cell and Melanie is like, telling her to get up and take her seat, and then Kim does it again and then does it again.
Yes,
that takes up like 2 minutes. It's just like it's this completely like, first off, Melanie doesn't really feel like she's done a lot of time. So I feel like she doesn't really feel like she's quite in that, you know, in that headspace. And, you know, I mean, like, you know, obviously there's just the regular bullying possibility. Yeah. But still, it's just, it's just so forced.
Yeah, the jail cell scenes are some of the most just, like, offensive scenes of the show. But at least in these episodes, something happens other than just, like, menacing camera views of non-white people. At the same time, though, the whole Melanie Kim thing is, like, stretched out over 4 episodes. That's unforgivable.
Yes. Elisha Cooper does her best to sell the speech that she gives to Melanie. But it's just, you know, you have to have that. Then you have to have the scene where Melanie gets a joint thrown on her.
Even though,
like, there's... It's a completely insane thing to smoke a joint in a jail cell. Like, I can understand prison, but a jail cell, like, where you're just around a bunch of people and there's guards everywhere, it doesn't make sense to me. And so you have to have that scene. Then you have the scene where the detective takes her out of the cell. Then you have the scene where the detective is apologizing to Kim in the car.
Yeah.
And it's just all this stuff.
I don't want to give Elisha Cuthbert a hard time.
Yeah,
because this is not... There's not a lot of material to work with here. Mm-hmm. But, like, I mean, are we really deciding after 22 episodes that the arc here is, you know, Kim's, like, self-actualization? Like, because the other girl is right. Kim Bauer is just a spoiled little princess. And, like, yeah, you've had one bad day.
Yeah.
Okay, but... And it's pretty bad. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, she's been through a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Rough day, but
yeah,
man, that speech just feels like ugh.
Yeah, you know, like this, it's just a thing where, like, you know, a bad day versus like a lifetime of like small little things accumulating.
Yeah,
like it's there's you know, certainly arguments to be made that she's had a rougher life than Kim has. I do like the like sort of scarred knuckles that Kim has though.
That's a nice touch.
I
was glad to see that. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think that's like one of the little details that's really trying to kind of juice that scene. And it's not the worst scene the show has done, but it definitely felt so just like, let's get this over with.
Yeah, you don't like, you know, you can make the speech that Jack gives to Rick work. That sort of like moralizing thing. Like it sort of works because, you know, Jack is Jack.
Yes.
And he actually definitively has had like a lifetime of experiences of this absolute hell stuff. But Kim, no, absolutely not.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also, now that I'm thinking about it, it feels like it's trying to be a movie scene, like a big moment for this character.
Yes.
Which, like, maybe
an Oscar clip.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, like, maybe in the 2-hour movie version of 24. Like, you could maybe sell it, right?
Yeah.
But when we have spent so long dragging every moment out with this character, it was never going to land. No matter how well acted it is, it was just never going to hit the way that they... Like, I can imagine the writers writing this, you know, like, getting all hyped about it, being like, wow, this is such a big breakthrough. It's like, it was never going to land that way. Like, it's just never going to work that way because of how everything that builds up to that.
Mm-hmm.
And it still feels like such a kind of like desperate attempt to make this person a real character and not just, you know, a prop in a plot. And I think sometimes you just got to be like, all right, this isn't a character. It's just a prop. Let's have as much fun with it as we can, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's where 24 works really well with these side characters, is to be like, yeah, okay, you're a type, you're a stock, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. but we're gonna like max it out, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we're gonna max all your stats, and you won't be a real person, but you'll be something like more fun than that.
Yeah.
And they just like, and I get why they're not doing that with Kim, but it puts them in mm-hmm. a weird spot because it's definitely not their strong suit.
Yeah, it's also kind of funny to me that Terry will never know that Kim got in this weird drug deal situation, like, because she'll never hear about it, right? Because they won't
ever talk again.
Yeah.
I think it was two episodes ago. I think it's been two episodes where they had their last conversation.
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe even it's been even longer.
Last in person, I think it was when the car went over the cliff.
Yeah, in person, that's the last time they see each other. But they've talked. Have they talked on the phone?
I don't think they've been in a position to.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah,
maybe it has been that long.
It's been like 5-6 hours, I guess.
Yeah, it was definitely in the trivia at some point on IMDb that I'm I've lost track of where exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It was at. Did we want to talk about the best part of these episodes?
Well, first we have to talk about Jack inexplicably losing his nerve.
Oh, yeah.
On multiple occasions.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, like, it's the thing where, you know, you probably know he's not going to kill a hostage in cold blood, but he's just giving up these feints so readily. He takes way too many L's in these episodes.
I think that, you know, this is part of the evolution of the character a little bit, is that in a couple seasons, Jack takes the shot when Hopper's holding on to Lou Diamond Phillip. Is it Hopper? Yeah. Or is it?
No, it's a...
No.
Zelko and Vana.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, Jack takes that shot 10 times mm-hmm. out of 10 times.
Yeah.
Because he knows. He's like... You're dead anyways. It's not going to matter. the thing where he takes the woman hostage at least feels like a real desperate gambit.
Yeah.
Like maybe like he's just searching for whatever he can do. Mm-hmm. I sort of get that.
And, you know, he's not being surrounded by weapons.
Yeah.
Like he can walk. He can try to move his way up the stairs.
Yeah.
And, you know. He actually has some options.
Yeah, but because that scene comes after the earlier scene, it feels mm-hmm. like, again, like 24 does this thing where it's like, all right, our characters have to be really stupid for a minute now to make this work. And again, like they overplay it because the second time I would totally buy is an isolated incident. Like I think that scene, and that scene works well because it's like, okay, yes, you know, these are really bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
But in the first scene, it's like obviously they're just gonna kill it. Like you're all dead here, probably.
Yeah, yeah. You know that they're here to kill you.
Yeah, and maybe that's kind of part of the sort of like hardening of Jack as a character mm-hmm. after this mm-hmm. season, when he kind of becomes Jack Bauer. But yeah, that moment just felt so just stupid. Like, just like completely giving the game away. Like later season mm-hmm. Jack would have just like shot Lou Diamond Phillips and Zelko Ivanek through the head, just been like, sorry bro, had to do it to him.
Yeah
But yeah, first season Jack is not up to the task.
No, definitely not. But yeah, man, Dennis Hopper.
I mean
it's great that he has his accent on maybe like 45% of the time. and so sometimes you hear him saying like a, it's not even like a really a Frank Booth voice. It's more like, I don't know. It's like, you know,
it's a little bit
probably
Frank
closer
Booth.
To like, a little bit Frank Booth, a little bit like Hoosiers or something like that. You know, it's like somewhere in that, you know, it's like sort of, I guess, you know, Dennis Hopper, he has a voice, but it's also like not quite, you know, it's not one that you would easily imitate.
He has a pretty flat affect.
Yeah.
Too.
Mm-hmm. Which sometimes works with the accent, sometimes doesn't.
Yeah, it's sort of weird how sometimes it pops out as like particularly American and other times it feels in keeping with the sort of like Bela Lugosi thing he's doing. I honestly, you know what? Putting aside that, you know, objectively speaking, it's bad. Okay. I love it. It's fantastic. Totally. I love it on multiple levels. I love it because, again, much like Penny Johnson Gerald, like because he doesn't respect this as like high art. He's like, oh yeah, okay, I'm like a cartoon.
Yeah.
I can be cartoon villain guy. So like on the one hand, I love that choice. I love going all the way.
Yeah.
Because not only does he do the accent, he's also just like always snarling when he speaks. But then on top of that, I just love seeing Dennis Hopper turn in one of the laziest performances of his career and get paid an enormous amount of money for it. Like, my man was just on set having a good time and getting paid.
Yeah.
And I think that's beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, it's the thing, like, you know, he's, even though he's technically the main villain of this first season, he's not in it for, he's only in it for like 5 episodes.
Yes.
So you don't really need to spend time characterizing. Like with Ira, you know, had.
Yes. Yeah.
You had Massey turning in some like really good, like sort of unpredictable stuff.
Yeah.
But you need a sledgehammer, which is what Dennis Hopper is bringing.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, when he says like, we might need him as a bargaining chip.
It's so good when he's like comforting his friend whose daughter he's just shot. These are what our enemies want. Just almost like Pinky in the Brain.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't know. He's like hobbling around. He doesn't seem to be. I don't know if he was like ill at the time or what, but he is making up for it though. And I think you make a good point, which is that he's kind of freed up in a way other villains in the series are not, because he mm-hmm. just arrives as like the big bad, like the yeah. final boss.
Mm-hmm.
And so he can just be this cartoonish villain because this is the, you know, this is the crescendo yeah. of the show. Yeah.
You've been talking about him for like, for 12 episodes or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to sort of sell it. You know, it's like, I don't know, it's sort of like Orson Welles in The Third Man. Obviously, he has more time afterwards, but you know, you need that sort of impact of his character appearance after that, and you need someone like Hopper to do it. And it's just funny watching him like interact with people who are actually from the Baltic region.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder how offensive it was to him doing this.
Well, you know, he's just like, you get like, it's sort of, it really reminded me of the scene in Texas Chainsaw Massacre where the family's eating and the final girl's just there. It's like Jack is just like slumped in a corner while they're just chowing down and just like making small talk. It's also, you know, has similar shades to like when Frank Booth shows up at Dean Stockwell's house.
Yeah,
so,
I mean,
it's just like that friendliness.
Yeah, and even I think this is one of the best sets the show has
had. Yeah.
So it's so interesting because I don't really have a good conception of like what kind of space this is or what's going on, but it's so evocative in a way. A lot of the more nondescript locations.
Yeah, it feels like a place. It feels like a place that, you know, like a family would run, and just like this, you know, cozy place which has lots of good food,
yeah,
stuff like that. So it just gets taken down by I noticed this, but when he's when he like takes that shot of, I think it's vodka, and when he takes that shot of vodka, he looks exactly like the Bosnian guy who died by suicide by drinking poison.
In the
courtroom.
Oh no.
He has the exact same, and also maybe just the, like the beard he has, but it's just this.
Oh yeah, he's got this goatee.
Yeah,
it's both a performance that I don't think the show will ever like replicate, and also at the same time sets the template, I think, for later villains on the show, because you kind of like Hopper kicks the door open to a certain kind of characterization that up until then I don't think the show was quite willing to commit to. And it kind of and you know, much like the show is uneven in this way, that I don't think we'll always get these kind of big over the top villains, but I can think, if I'm remembering correctly, of at least a couple performances that I think are at least in the spirit of Hopper, if not if yeah. not following directly after him.
Yeah, when you talk about sort of like cartoonish things, like even the characters that are like playing and the actors who are playing into a type like Mason or Sherry Palmer, like even those, like, you know, they clearly are trying to work to make some nuance or some sort of you know, shades, other shades.
Yeah.
Hopper is simply not going to do any of that. And the screenwriters are happy to oblige. Yeah. It's just,
I like to think he was just on set improvising the dialogue.
Yeah. And I like how you get, like, Zelka Ivanic looks like spry and athletic and like and gung ho compared to him, because like, you get that scene where Jack knocks Dennis Hopper over, is trying to escape, but then Zelka Ivanic is like pistol whips him.
Yeah.
And he's like wearing this like weird like black, like it's almost like a cat suit.
Yeah, it's like a cat burglar kind of outfit. Yeah,
it's really good.
Yeah,
and Alexis comes back, and even though he's apparently lost like 2 liters of blood, he's actually talking.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
like after Mason and after like everyone saying, "Oh, it's worse than we thought," he's just talking and conscious. Yeah.
Mason's like, "He's fine." I loved that. That was so good.
I like how you also get this random guy handling that transaction. Like, it's fun, and you get that. It's actually, I was really impressed by the shot that Shapiro does of the sort of like rack focuses in and out on the handcuff chain and the oil derrick that's in the background.
Yes, yeah.
And like it comes back, and then the chain gets shot off by a sniper.
Yeah.
Which is incredibly accurate work.
Yeah, don't miss.
Yeah. There's a moment, I think it's just in a split screen, but where when they're in the car and it looks like Hopper's just taking a nap.
Oh yeah. Sorry, I was looking at my notes real quick.
Yeah.
Again, like Hopper is outside of the accent, you know, he's not moving around a lot. But it's such a crazed performance. Like that almost makes it nuttier.
Yes.
That he's just like kind of maniacal, but kind of doddering at the same time.
Yeah. He's looks like he's in his 80s or something like that.
Yeah. He was probably in his 60s when he was doing this, right?
I guess. Hopper? He didn't die that old.
Yeah, I think he was like 73 or 74.
Yeah, he died 2010 and he was 74, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So he would have been
in his 60s.
Yeah.
But he looks a lot older, which is perfectly fitting for, you know, this sort of scarred guy who's committed immense numbers of war crimes.
Yeah, and then he's been like like being shuttled around underground, you know.
It's such a great sort of bastard move by Chappelle to say if they try to like recapture him or something like that, that it would be an embarrassment for them to admit that he's actually alive. It's just really, really funny that idea.
I love the Chappelle line when he's on the phone with Mason and reaming him out. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I'm not talking hours, I'm talking minutes.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I love the little winks the show gives to time like that.
On the flip side, you have Kim saying, like, what I've gone through over the past 24 hours.
Yeah. Like, a little on the nose, but also something people say. So I'm like, I'll allow it, you know.
Yeah.
I do think, despite these episodes not necessarily being a high point in the show, I do think they give us like several good phone conversations.
Yeah, I think so.
Because you get that Chappelle and Mason one, you get the one with Mason and Palmer, which is great.
Oh yeah.
Like these characters haven't really spoken very much up until this point, right?
Yeah. And you get the like also the nice sort of formal one between Nina and Palmer.
Yeah.
And then Palmer just has the great reaction of realizing that Drazen is still alive.
Yeah.
Also, apparently the name of these underground prisons is the Mobile Underground Detention and Detainment, otherwise standing for MUD.
You know what? I believe it. I believe that that's the kind of bullshit they're pulling at DOD. Or whoever. I forget.
Yeah.
I forget. Is it DOD? Is that the agency that Chappelle's complaining about?
Yeah, I think so. Other agencies, basically, which is really the whole problem with the show is other agencies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, also the laser C4.
Yeah.
With these just giant lasers, like 8 of them just strung across the sewage pipe.
The writers are doing such fascinating stuff with C4, C5 lasers.
Yeah. Yes.
They love talking gear. Wait, speaking of which, something that's dropped off of the IMDb trivia is the gear.
Oh, yeah.
I've been keeping an eye out. We're not getting, you know, the make and model of the phones and guns anymore.
Yeah, that's
a
shame.
This is a show about phones and guns, basically.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great tagline. Maybe we should have called the podcast Phones and Guns.
Yeah. As Godard famously said, all you need to make a TV show is a phone and a gun.
Though our sort of odd friend, the Internet Movie Firearms Database, still has a full selection of the guns used.
Of course they do. Of course they do.
Yeah, it's an interesting database, to say the least. Yeah. Not by episode, though, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I found the trivia so fascinating. It's like someone was watching these episodes and identifying, you know, the guns, whatever, but I was way more interested in the person identifying the specific models of phones, like in the CTU office.
Yeah, the scrambled phone that the Drazens give to Jack.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, like, I really miss when it wasn't just like, oh, this show obviously has Apple bankrolling their gear because everybody's using Macs and iPhones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When it was just like actual props, you know, even though they're like real things.
It
feels more real than, you know, everybody having the latest mm-hmm. and the same make and model of phone.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, the aesthetic preference for flip phones is, you know, a thing that happens, but
it is
just dramatically cooler.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And you know, you get a lot of like wired phones in the show.
Oh yeah, the wired phones.
It's like an office setting.
Terry just sitting there for 30 minutes in front of the phone.
Yeah, I do. You know, another thing, and I don't think we mentioned it earlier, but Kim is on her way forever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know Terry's having a hard time, but she doesn't really seem to pick up on it.
Yeah.
That, like, they're obviously putting you off.
Yeah. Like, she doesn't trust them about Jack, but she trusts them about Kim.
Yeah, she's like, oh, well, you know, Kim is fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also definitely think it was way too premature for Nina to tell her that Jack was probably going to die. Jack is Jack. He has his ways.
Yeah. Well, and this is another thing, you know, I don't know. This, again, becomes like, what is Jack's reputation in universe?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is the first time this has happened to him.
Yeah.
You know, in this way, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it happened to him many more times, but...
Yes.
So, like, you know, I think one of the things about the show later on that becomes ridiculous is, like, mm-hmm. in the classic way that such things go, like, Jack, despite his hypercompetency, despite the fact that, you know, he has this rep, he's always being disbelieved, he's always being, mm-hmm. you know, there's always red tape, there's always this, and that's, like, part of the genre tropes.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about this season is, like, all that stuff makes sense, because, like, Jack is really just some guy,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, maybe he's particularly good at his job, you know, maybe, you know, he's getting called to these special task forces and stuff, but I don't think he's, like, Jack Bauer yet.
Yeah.
So this, like, is, like, an origin story without doing an origin story.
Right. You know? I mean, it's basically sort of the Ethan Hunt, John McClane sort of trajectory.
Yeah.
And, of course, we have to mention here that they were intending to make a 24 Die Hard crossover movie.
Oh, they were, weren't
yeah.
they?
I think it was going to be called 24 Hours to Die Hard or something like that.
Oh, man. I had totally forgotten about that.
That would be, I mean, it'd be fun. I mean, you know, obviously Bruce Willis, Die Hard 24/7, which is even better, I think.
Wow.
But, you know, obviously wonderful work in the past, and hope that, you know, he enjoys his retirement, Bruce Willis. But, like, it would have been so fascinating to watch Kiefer, who's basically, for the most part, always bringing it.
Yeah.
Against like, very late career Bruce Willis, like DTV era Bruce Willis.
Yeah,
that sort of contrast in approaches would be really interesting to me, I think.
Yeah, when exactly would this have been?
I mean, after the end of season 8, so like 2010.
Okay, so fairly late. Yeah.
Yeah, so a few years before A Good Day to Die Hard.
Okay.
Which I've never seen.
I think the last Die Hard movie I saw was the one where Justin Long plays his son.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's... Oh, wait, no. I think that is the... Wait, no. He's also in Live Free or Die Hard, right?
I think that's the one.
Yeah, that's mid-2000s.
Yeah. Okay, so Live Free or Die Hard would have come before the 24 crossover.
Yeah.
And then A Good Day to Die Hard. Okay, yeah.
I think that they definitely began the show thinking that Jack was going to be like a, you know, like a spy, like James Bond meets Dirty Harry sort of thing.
Yeah. He definitely has more of a John McClane thing going on though.
Yeah.
By the end. Mm-hmm. Because of course, like we already have an American James Bond, and it's Batman. as Christopher Nolan understood.
Yes.
But
oh man, I feel like we're gonna be talking about the Nolan Batmans at some point on this podcast.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
that'll be an interesting discussion.
Yeah, you know, I actually this is going way off topic now, but
oh, sure.
It's fine. You know, I saw the new Batman, which, you know, whatever. it's fine.
I'll get around to it.
It's, you don't need to.
Well, I know I don't need to actually. for Pattinson and Kravitz and Farrell. The weirdly sad cast they have.
Really, Farrell is... You know what? It is worth it for Farrell. I will say that. If you're just watching it at home, like, having a good time, like, it is worth it for Colin Farrell's performance.
Yeah. I've seen the clip where he says, like, holy God, what are you showing that, I mean, that for? Come on! I've seen that probably, like, 50 times at this point. It's great.
Yeah, that is fantastic. Mm-hmm. But I did, because my brother was staying with us at the time, and he's like a big comic book head, so we just ended mm-hmm. up watching other Batman movies just because that's what we were in the mood for, and I was like kind of curious to see the comparisons. It's been ages since I've watched any of them, and mm-hmm. honestly, like, man, we got to talk about it on the show because I think Dark Knight Rises, in retrospect, is like one of the most interesting Hollywood films of the last 20 years. It's such a weird, strange, like, fouillade riff.
I've heard this from Matt Lynch also, and I'm still not convinced. I'll need you to.
I was aside from the unusual circumstances where it was like someone else was picking the movie and I didn't really care.
Yeah.
I would have never returned to that film. I would have, like, I saw it in theaters. I thought it was bad then. I think I saw it one more time, maybe like half paying attention on TV or something, mm-hmm. and didn't think it was anything interesting then. But yeah, watching it this time, and I don't know, maybe it's just like, I worry sometimes that like what's happening is that slowly the kind of big, ugh, and this is so boring to talk, like this is just a boring opinion to have, but it's true. But it just feels like the bar keeps getting lower.
Oh, sure.
So yeah. I'm returning to stuff that I, at the time, just wasn't that interested in, and mm-hmm. finding that it's like way more weird and interesting than I had remembered. But I don't know if that's just in retrospect because now everything is just so bland, mm-hmm. or if it's because it's like genuinely interesting. Dark Knight Rises is not like a masterpiece or anything, but I did find it oddly compelling, and especially having like I'm sort of like slowly picking my way through Fouillade again. I gotta watch Les Vampires again because I want to see that new Irma Vep show.
Ooh, it sounds much more interesting than I was anticipating, which is a good sign.
Yeah, I've been getting hyped for it over the last like week or so because people have been mm-hmm. really on top of it. But yeah, I mean, I think that the Nolan Batman movies are in some ways an interesting counterpoint to, but also kind of a companion to the 24 ethos, mm-hmm. since they run like pretty concurrently in time. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm happy to talk about them, but we also have to talk about the White Storm 2, which basically has Andy Lau playing Batman.
I have not seen it.
It's really good.
Okay,
it's
okay. Fine. I'll have to watch it.
So we'll talk about that. But,
okay, that's great. We've gotten off
back
track
to,
here.
Back to Jack. Yeah, I mean, like, these two episodes are really like Jack being shuttled around, which is, you know, Kiefer makes it work.
It's a nice change of pace a little bit from other people being shuttled around.
That's true. And, you know, you get some good yelling. I like that scene where he's just looking around the room after he's been plopped down
Next
to the table.
Yeah.
and I do like him just declining the offers to eat. Yeah, you get that, and you also get him washing his face without drinking water.
Yeah.
Like, you get that entire thing where he's splashing water on his face, even though he's obviously wide awake.
Yeah.
He has 10 p.m. now.
For a long time.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of, the CTU people have been, and the main cast has been up for 24 hours, but...
Well, I mean
also it's insane to think that...
Because, like, you think Jack probably got up for work, let's say, around 6 or 7 in the morning mm-hmm. before, so he's going on, like 36, 40 hours by the end of this.
Yeah, and you could, like, Palmer was, up and about and, like, working on things at midnight.
Yeah.
But it's just weird to think of, like, a politician staying up for 24 hours straight. You don't really get, like, unless he, like, napped into the car, I don't think you really get any times where Palmer could have napped.
Yeah, it's been pretty hectic mm-hmm. for him to... Yeah, I sort of get the impression that... And I think, like, the Trump presidency made this more apparent mm-hmm. Because he was just, like, a psycho tweeting. But I really don't think, particularly if you're, a president, that you probably don't sleep a lot. And you probably don't sleep well. One, because, you're constantly fighting off the knowledge that you're absolutely going to hell. And two, because, like, there's just always things, like, to do and to occupy your attention. I mean, maybe this is not true of Joe Biden, because I don't know that he could stay up for 24 hours. But, I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why you see this, like, rapid aging with people in the presidency. Palmer being up. I mean, everybody's been up for a long time. I wish the show kind of pushed that a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Just people being exhausted, that sort of thing. We should have, like, one of those last rampages, like, last hour rampages, like, we're going to get very soon. But Jack is just incredibly tired and just missing all the time.
Yeah, I want to see some, like, bleary shots of, like, the camera's, like, blurring out and shaky and exhausted. I'm very much looking forward to the finale, though, because, like you mentioned earlier, this really does not feel like we're only two episodes away from the end.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels like everything feels is like, so...
It's just mid-season. Like, you get Jack being told to get into another car, that sort of thing.
It's been mid-season for 10 episodes. That's what it's been.
Yes, definitely. I wonder when was the last time that someone actually won all 11 states in Super Tuesday, or all the states in Super Tuesday.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We didn't really talk about the actual. Yeah. We finally get, like, actual election returns.
But still, like, basically no. Like, we get a name mentioned, but we can't tell if it was another person in the primary or if it's the Republican opponent or something like that. So you still don't really, he says at one point that they were down 10 points, which frankly doesn't seem like it doesn't seem possible for someone like Palmer.
Maybe, like,
simply because he's, like, so, I don't know, so charismatic. Well, he's presented that way.
Primaries can be kind of volatile. So, if they started campaigning, say, mm-hmm. in, like, September, October, maybe they were down by 10 points at some point, like, nationally.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Because the one thing about primaries that's so weird and mm-hmm. contrived is the way that it kind of goes in these groupings.
Yeah.
So that, like, the national polling really ends up mattering a lot less than where you are in certain states at a certain mm-hmm. point.
Right. Which is, Biden.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? On the one hand, I was like, okay, yeah, there's just, like, political speech. He was down 10 points, blah, blah, blah. But then I was mm-hmm. also like, well, that could have been, like, October or whatever. That mm-hmm. could have been before, mm-hmm. that could have been months before anybody cast a vote. Although, the 11 states is a little conspicuous. They they could at least, maybe on the one hand, they're just like, yeah, we want it to be clear that, like, Palmer is probably going to become president.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it would be kind of fun to juice it a little bit and be like, well, mm-hmm. You won, like, 8 out of 11 and it's not quite over yet or. But I think by next season he is just, like, fully president, right?
Yeah.
Okay. We don't get the actual presidential election.
Probably for the best, but
almost certainly for the best. Yeah.
I'm also sad that we won't get to see Mason just hanging around the Pentagon.
Well, I was reading, I think it was on the 24 wiki, makes mention of the fact that he does not get this promotion, and he even makes a snide remark about it in a couple of seasons, which I think is pretty funny. Like, this does not seem like a show that would dig back in the continuity for that, so I like to believe that Xander Berkeley remembered it. Like, hey, so wasn't my guy supposed to be like way up there now, and he just got sold out by Palmer?
He should have been made vice president at some point in the show.
Oh my gosh, that would be beautiful. Secretary of Defense.
Yeah, or maybe Homeland, like, Security, I don't know, or something. He should have been basically playing LBJ. He should have been just giving the treatment to everybody.
Xander Berkeley definitely would be a guy like giving an interview and going and just like sitting on the toilet while he's George Mason would 100% do that.
Yeah, I believe that Mason smoked a lot in the past, but once he retires from CTU, he's just gonna immediately start smoking again.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, grow his hair long, slowly start to unravel.
Man, they should have got him in the First Lady series as LBJ.
Yeah, I was just remembering that I have to watch that at some point.
Yeah, I mean, we both do. So.
I was dreading it.
Yeah, we still haven't gotten around to, was it the contractor or the one that Kiefer's in? The one with Chris Pine?
Yeah. That did briefly blip in and out of theaters here. It never lined up with my schedule to go see it. I'm sure it's streaming by now.
Yeah, we'll get around to it at some point.
Yeah, that's worth watching.
Director's follow-up film is not doing too badly in the Cannes jury grid.
Well, it's kind of nuts that he's got a, like, I mean, I think, I don't know what Kiefer's doing with his career right now, but I definitely think he's still got that, like, one foot where he could all of a sudden make a hard pivot into doing, like, the next David Cronenberg movie or something.
Oh, man.
You know, like... right now he's sort of doing kind of a weird thing, like, okay, making some money doing the prestige TV stint, kind of in these, you know, actioners as like a kind of elder statesman sort of operator guy. But he doesn't really have anything on the slate, at least on IMDb, after this next movie that I think he's finishing up now that's like an espionage thing. But yeah, I'm really interested to see... Yeah. I hope he makes a hard pivot, like does another Von Trier or something.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Cannes lineup again, and he should be in a Dardenne film.
Oh, dang! Yeah.
I say this as a bit as a fan of the Dardenne, but he should be.
I'm just pro Kiefer Sutherland making a kind of late career turn into just art house fare.
Yeah, he should become the next Brady Corbet.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, it looks like. I misspoke here. It looks like the Rabbit Hole is a TV series. In my mind, I thought it was a movie. But it's like a, you know, it's one of those like 8-episode deals. I don't know I don't know how much, I don't even know how much Kiefer's in it. I don't think he's the main character, but I think he's an important side character.
Yeah.
I've tweeted about it at some point. I'll go back and read those. But yeah, that's like it. He doesn't have anything on after that. Maybe he's still hoping to tour. The album, you know, he'll take a year off, but yeah, he needs to he needs to get back into movies. We need Kiefer back in the movies. Maybe he can be in like Avatar 6 or something. I feel like him and James Cameron would get along.
What if he played the Stephen Lang role in Avatar?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
we should start like a fan petition to get Kiefer Das in the Avatar movies.
Yeah, Tariq Saleh's film is at 2.3 out of 4, which is just a bit higher than average. The jury's been giving, or the Screen International jury's been giving it a little bit higher ratings than usual, but yeah.
Yeah, that's not bad. I mean, you know, like, there are a lot of mid films that can.
Oh, yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
It would be interesting if Tariq Saleh ended up, you know, sort of unexpectedly winning some of those awards and then brings Kiefer on for like his follow-up or something at Cannes. I would love to see Kiefer Sutherland at Cannes. He could be in some kind of film with like Juliette Binoche or someone.
A Claire Denis film.
Yeah. Oh, man. That would be fantastic.
Kiefer and Vincent Lindon squaring off. Man.
Yeah, that's the dream. That's the dream right there. Kiefer's agent needs to get on it.
Yeah, we should become Kiefer's agents.
He's got the clout.
Yeah.
He should be getting some of these roles, you know. He could become, if he really lets himself go, he could become the American Gerard Depardieu. Oh, man. It would be kind of in line with his, like, Orson Welles-ishness. Mm-hmm. He's got to do, like, the fat Orson phase.
Yeah. I'm thinking again about how, like, Nick Pinkerton made the difference between Huppert and Depardieu. It's like Depardieu, like, had the like physique of a linebacker, but he's just like totally broken behind the eyes. So it's just like, you know, I could see Kiefer getting to that point at some point, even though he's taken walking down Bloor Street has made him a happier man.
Yeah, I mean, look, first and foremost, this is, you know, is a person's mental and physical well-being. But that being said, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for art. That's okay. As long as you're the one choosing to do that and to, like, mm-hmm. make those sacrifices. And I think Kiefer at heart he's an artist, you know?
Yes.
He's been, you know, these have kind of been wilderness years since at least
Designated Survivor
ended. I could see him getting another TV gig, because, like, that's pretty good work, you know?
Yeah.
I don't begrudge anybody that kind of stability. Maybe he'll be in, like, you know, one of those spinoffs of Yellowstone or
whatever. Yeah, how has he not been in a Taylor Sheridan film?
Yeah, I definitely feel like that. Like, he's waiting for that call.
Yeah,
that call's gonna happen. Yeah, you know, there hasn't been, like, a big, you know, long running kind of Western prestige show in a while. I think Kiefer would be good for that, you know. I keep seeing ads for this Billy the Kid show, but it looks like a fake 30 Rock mm-hmm. show, so I just choose to believe it doesn't exist.
He should have played Rick Dalton Oh
my god. Can you imagine him doing that scene in the trailer? You know, I really do think Damian Lewis looks eerily like Steve McQueen. I've thought this for like a decade and a half.
Yeah.
But I think Kiefer could have embodied the spirit of Steve McQueen better.
He would have made Steve McQueen a bigger part also.
Also, like, Steve McQueen, short king. Like, yeah. Damian Lewis, too tall. As a person who is, you know, 5'9 on a good day, I thought that was, you know, a little deceptive on Tarantino's part.
Sure.
I really have nothing else to say about these. Yeah.
No, no more quotes, right?
I was going through my notes. I took very sparse notes on these episodes. Yeah.
The brief moment where Palmer comes back to the party and it's like, and like after he's come back, he's like talking to like this guy who did AIDS research or something like that.
Oh yeah.
Just this completely random thing.
Yeah.
I was half expecting, like, when Sherry said that she had someone she wanted to see, like, that she was correcting him. He was not right about the subject, but
I like that Celebrate Good Times is playing in the background.
Yeah.
That's a good choice.
The party scene vaguely reminds me of Something Wild, I guess.
Oh yeah, yeah. I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. Just like, you know, the general fanfare, you know, Americana thing of it all.
Yeah. I actually think, like, a lot, I feel like I've slacked on the writers a lot this episode. I do think they are actually doing a good job giving you, like, the inside of a political campaign that's just scored a major victory. Like, the Palmer speech is really good, and I think Haysbert plays it really, really well, because he kind of has this, like, we've seen him in these private moments, and Palmer is like, you know, he's like sort of an honest kind of guy, but he is markedly different in his private moments than in his kind of like public persona. And so that's like really good, the way he's like able to do the kind of smile and wave type thing, and the glad handing. And then, yeah, just the general vibe of the party feels like very true to to this kind of world.
Just
right?
people awkwardly milling about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that reminds me, we haven't even, like, Madison Cawthorn got taken down in between in between our last recording.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Elections have been happening.
Yes.
This is a show that's so tangentially about electoral politics.
Yeah.
Part of me wishes we got a little more of the nitty-gritty, like the the dirt. Because, you know, he's got these financial backers and, and all, and that still remains shadowy. Yeah.
Oh, there's that thing where he says to, like where they've already notified the other major donors, like that he was not, didn't know, and that like he's going to sit down with all of them and like explain or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I would have liked to see that.
Yeah, some of that stuff just feels like it's so hard because it's just a little too distant, I think, from the main action of the show to get into. But I do remember there being more of that kind of stuff later on.
Yeah.
Once he's in the White House, but like, you know, the kind of deep state stuff.
Yeah,
but not a great string of episodes, but but I'm glad we're back, and I'm also very excited to see how they managed to pull all this together for the last two episodes.
I think that they'll put it all in. I don't know if they'll pull it all together.
Well, yeah, okay, yeah. It's more like, you know, time to just throw everybody in the pot. And
yeah, this is like the Halo 2 production. They said like they're basically landing the airplane and then nosedive at like a million miles per hour with the engines on fire. Yes, I feel like this is basically a similar thing.
Yeah. No, this is absolutely the same.
Yes. So please join us hopefully in actually 2 weeks to witness how they land/crash this airplane.
It's going
crashing down. This plane with no survivors.
No, with a designated survivor. Jack Bauer. He lives.
Always.
Spoiler alert.